From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. Many medical drugs are in short supply in the U.S. What can be done to protect patients? We asked Dr. Yoram Unguru of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. Then a conversation with the co-authors of a blog called What's Your Grief? They describe how to connect with people who are going through the course of grieving.
We caution people from using any phrases that begin with at least or that minimize people's loss by saying, oh, well, you know, they're in a better place.
Plus, what happens when 10,000 scientists work to slam together particles moving near the speed of light? Tom Hall asks David Kaplan, Johns Hopkins physics professor and producer of the documentary Particle Fever. News first.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock. That's on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming at WYPR.org. Now, on with the podcast.
This is Maryland Morning on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Shortages of life-saving medicines and drugs are becoming increasingly common in the U.S. Since 2007, the number of drugs considered in short supply has tripled. That's according to a report released earlier this year from the federal government. Many of the drugs in short supply are generic, sterile, injectable drugs. Some are to control pain. Others fight infections, treat heart problems, enable nutrition, or battle cancer. When there's a shortage, how do doctors decide who gets medication or treatment and who doesn't? Dr. Yoram Unguru joined me to walk through this topic. He's a faculty member at the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Ethics and a pediatric hematologist-oncologist at the Herman and Walter Samuelson Children's Hospital at Sinai Hospital of Baltimore. Dr. Unguru is part of a working group which published in the journal Pediatrics a sort of blueprint for how to prevent chemotherapy drug shortages. When we spoke in February, I asked how often he's been faced with a drug shortage.
We have shortages frequently. Oftentimes, we're able to figure ways to get around those shortages. The shortages may require that we give our patients the medications at times when they're not necessarily due so that we can avoid an actual shortage.
You get ahead of the treatment schedule to avoid a shortage, or you delay it?
Both. For example, a common drug that was short a couple of years ago was a drug called methotrexate. And we use that drug for different types of kids with cancer. And we knew that drug was short, and we would have to bring kids in to batch them. So we would bring kids ahead of their schedule or after their schedule to give them the drug because we had an announcement from the FDA or the drug manufacturers that there was going to be a shortage. So we tried to use it as fast as we could. The problem then became that what do you do when there's an actual shortage of that drug? And that, for the most part, we've been able to avoid with that specific drug. But we've had other drugs that have been in short supply as well. And that's the tragic, difficult choice that you have to make.
But overall, how would you describe the consequences of drug shortages?
These shortages have a huge impact. And I hesitated because we're not sure to what extent the shortages are going to impact the lives of kids. I can tell you that there have been children who have been impacted immediately, but for example, when we've had to give medications not at the scheduled time, we don't know what the impact of that shortage is going to be. We in childhood cancer practice what we call evidence-based medicine. We're very data-driven. In other words, we give medicines based on clinical trials and years of evidence. And suddenly, we are now forced to give drugs in a schedule that isn't known or to give an alternative drug that we don't know necessarily what its influence is going to be on that child's disease. And so we're not sure what's going to happen. And we honestly are keeping our fingers crossed. But imagine having to tell a child or the child's parents, we're not sure how this is going to impact you because we have a shortage of this drug, which should be available and isn't.
I think many of us think of shortages of drugs as something that happens in developing countries. Why are there drug shortages in the U.S.?
That's a great question. And while there are shortages in some other countries, this is primarily a problem here in the United States.
More than in other countries?
Much more than in other countries. In fact, I've queried colleagues of mine abroad, do you guys have shortages? And they think I'm joking. Why would we have shortages?
So yeah, why would we have shortages? My question.
Okay, it's a great question. So there's a lot of reasons why we have shortages. There are economic drivers behind this, manufacturing and quality issues. For example, you may be familiar, a year or two ago, there was the New England Compounding Company that produced an injectable form of a steroid that was tainted, and there was a lot of news reports of people getting fungal meningitis and things of that nature. So quality is a big problem. There's some regulatory considerations. Economics, though, I'll come back to that, is a big, big issue. A lot of these drugs, as I mentioned, have been around for decades. They're very cheap. The pharmaceutical companies don't get a lot of profit when they sell these. And maintaining a production line for some of these drugs is very costly. And they may decide that it's not worth their while to continue to produce this drug because they don't get a lot of profit.
I'm sorry. Let me make sure I understand that. You said the drug is very cheap. And you also said maintaining the production line is costly. And I presume a drug company prices to cover its costs.
They do. And you picked up on an important point here. A number of years ago, the federal government decided that it was going to reimburse differently on how a lot of these sterile injectables are made. And this is specifically Medicare reimbursement. In the past, drug companies were able and physicians were able to charge pretty much whatever they wanted for a lot of these drugs, and it resulted in skyrocketing prices. And in an effort to curb these skyrocketing prices, the federal government stepped in and set a ceiling on the amount of money they were going to reimburse for a lot of these drugs. And that amount of money is quite small. So the profit margin is quite small for some of these old, tried and true life-saving drugs. And at the end of the day, some of these manufacturing and pharmaceutical companies, they're a business. They have a bottom line to attend to. And so they may say, it's not worth our while to maintain this very costly production line. We have to meet standards that the FDA sets. We have a lot of money and infrastructure that goes into it. And when we're only being reimbursed a small amount, they may decide that they're going to essentially pull the plug. And what's important to appreciate is that there's consolidation within the marketplace. What I mean by that is there are very few companies that actually make these sterile injectable chemotherapeutics. In 2008, three companies alone, that's it, made 71% of all the sterile injectable cancer drugs. And they all had problems in their production line. And this is why in 2008, for example, there were a lot of shortages. And this continued up until 2012. So there's a lot of considerations that go into why these shortages exist.
On WIPR, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Kast, speaking with Dr. Yoram Ungaru. He's a faculty member at the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics and a pediatric hematologist-oncologist at the Herman and Walter Samuelson Children's Hospital at Sinai Hospital of Baltimore. We're talking about drug shortages. In your article in Pediatrics, you and your colleagues recommended six actions to address drug shortages. Your first recommendation is aimed at the Food and Drug Administration. And FDA officials wrote a response saying, hey, we're doing that. We're doing what they suggested already. So in simplest terms, tell me what it is you think the FDA should be doing more of or how it could make this situation better.
So I have sympathy for the FDA. They traditionally were tasked with the relatively easy, in quotation marks, job of making sure that the drugs that are used in the United States are safe and effective. And now they find themselves having to monitor drug shortages. And this isn't something that originally was in their purview. And they're trying to do this. The FDA is woefully understaffed, and they'll tell you this when it comes to this regard. There is a drug shortage program within the FDA, and it's staffed by 11 full-time employees. And they are forced to monitor and deal with these shortages. Now, what's interesting is the FDA doesn't monitor all shortages of drugs in the United States. Depending on which source you look at, there's about 300 drugs right now in the United States that are in short supply. If you look at the FDA's website and see how many drugs are in short supply, you'll see far fewer. And the reason for that is the FDA limits itself to monitoring shortages of only what's called medically necessary drugs, that is, drugs that are used for a serious medical condition for which there's no alternative. And the FDA is the first to admit the reason that they limit themselves to monitoring only this group of drugs is because they simply don't have the man or woman power to monitor all the drug shortages. And along those lines, while our emphasis is on the chemotherapy drugs that are used in childhood cancer, I would be remiss if I didn't mention that That's one small percentage of the drugs that are short. There's about 35 chemotherapeutics that have been short, but there, I told you there's 300 drugs that are in short supply. So these shortages affect every single person out there. You don't have to have cancer to be impacted by these shortages.
Right, and you make the point in your article that that while you're writing specifically about pediatric chemotherapy drugs, that you think that your recommendations would apply to a broader range of drugs. And you also point out in your article, which I didn't know, that about two-thirds of kids with cancer in the U.S. are part of a clinical trial of some kind of measurement of how this treatment, how effective it is. And that's why I want to ask you about what you flag as what you think will be the most controversial recommendation, which is that if a drug is in short supply, a patient in a clinical trial should not have any more claim to it than a patient not in a clinical trial. Why did you recommend that?
So this was, I think, the area that sparked the most debate within our working group. Our working group consisted of pediatric oncologists, bioethicists, folks with expertise in public policy, pharmacists, legal scholars, and we even had FDA representation there. And this was an area that really was, I won't say contentious, but got a little heated. So research, as you may know, is risky. In other words, we assume that whatever intervention, in this case, it's usually some form of treatment, is going to be better than the current standard of care. In other words, the current best approach. But we're not sure. That's why we're doing it under the guise of a research study. And the majority of kids, as you stated, do participate in a research trial at some point in the care of their cancer. And they're taking a risk. The intervention, the research part of their treatment may be better, it may not. And therefore, I think an argument could be made that these children are owed something because they're essentially taking one for the team.
So far, you've been arguing against your recommendation.
I'm getting there. Yes, I have. You've been listening. The reason, however, that we recommended that kids who are participating in research not get preferential access to getting a scarce drug is the following. We don't want kids and parents of kids with cancer to feel that they have to enroll in a research study in order to get access to a scarce drug. People should enroll in research because it's consistent with their values and preferences and they believe that the research study is something that is good for them. They shouldn't fear that the only way they're going to get a drug is if they enroll in the study, if they that study, though, is not good for them. So that's one reason. We don't want people to participate in research for the wrong reason. The other concern is the idea that we really think that when you're talking about a scarce drug, we should limit that drug's use to instances where there's clear evidence that it's proven to do something beneficial. And a research study hasn't proven that yet. That's the reason we do research. We're trying to prove that the drug or the intervention is to the benefit of the individual. And we haven't gotten there yet. And then the last reason, probably the least important of the three, but it is there's this fear of or not fear, this concern of how things will be perceived in the greater world if we're saying these kids who are participating in research are going to get preferential access. That could potentially be spun in a bad way.
Thank you. Thanks for explaining it to us.
Thank you.
Dr. Yoram Ungeru is a faculty member at the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics and a pediatric hematologist-oncologist at the Herman and Walter Samuelson Children's Hospital at Sinai Hospital of Baltimore. He was part of a working group which published in the journal Pediatrics a sort of blueprint for how to prevent chemotherapy drug shortages. We spoke in February. More information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. More ahead on Maryland Morning. Stay with us on 88.1.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or find us on Twitter. We are at Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Tom Hall. Baltimore residents Eleanor Haley and Litza Williams run a blog called What's Your Grief? that provides resources and support for people grieving the loss of a loved one. Both work in the field of mental health, but their personal experiences have as much impact on the essays they write as their professional background. The bloggers have a national reach, including other psychology professionals who use their posts to help grieving patients. I spoke with Eleanor Haley and Lisa Williams last April.
Morning.
Thank you so much.
So it's good to have you here. So, Lisa, tell us what the blog talks about.
Well, in its most basic form, I guess it talks about grief. But what we've found from when we started is that there is an endless supply of different topics within the scope of grief. So we have been writing for a little over a year now, and I think we've just scratched the surface of all of the different issues within grief and bereavement, where we are now.
So, Eleanor, the process of grieving is a very individual endeavor.
Absolutely. And I think that's one thing that people in society don't typically understand, because they hear the most common grief theory is the Kubler-Ross five-stage grief theory. They think that grief is going to follow a linear timeline. It's going to hit these stages, and when I get to the final stage, it will be, I'll be good. I'll be okay. And what people actually find is that when they are grieving, there is a range of responses, a range of emotions, a range of just crazy reactions and feelings they've never experienced before. And their grief is as individual as who they are and the relationship they had with that person. So their sibling or somebody who is grieving the same loss may grieve in a totally different way. So it's absolutely very individual process, which I think can be kind of confusing to people when they first start the grief journey.
Because Dr. Kubler-Ross back in 1969 was really suggesting that we all do it essentially the same way. We go through these five stages: denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and then finally acceptance.
Right.
You know, and people will say, well, you don't do them necessarily in that order, but you eventually get to acceptance.
Right. And I think that, you know, when they first put that theory out there, they, you know, over time, people hear them listed in this linear way. When their theory, you know, says you can bounce back and forth, revisit, you don't always go in the same linear pattern. But just the way it's applied in modern society, we typically think that it's going to hit these marks.
I think additionally what's important to understand about Kubler-Ross is that when she first put out this theory, though it later got adapted to people grieving a loss, it was initially intended for people who had been diagnosed with a terminal illness and how they were accepting their own loss. So that was initially where the stages came from. It was then later adapted to how we grieve a loss, but it was always thought to be these clear five stages, ending in acceptance, which I think is really deceptive for people because they think it will be tied up with a nice little bow and they'll be in the acceptance phase and they'll kind of close that chapter of their life and move on, which I don't think is ever what Kubler-Ross intended, but is certainly the way it's been adapted. Later grief theory has really now come to accept the idea that it's not going to get tied up with a little bow. There's going to be an ongoing relationship with that loss and that person.
Lisa Williams and Eleanor Haley run a blog called What's Your Grief on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. So let's talk a little bit about that. You've written a blog about a theory called continuing bonds theory of grief. And this is really diametrically opposed to this notion of acceptance. I have a friend who wrote a book called A Broken Heart Still Beats when her son was killed tragically in a car accident. She wrote it along with her friend Anne McCracken. Her name is Mary Semmel. And it's a collection of prose and poetry and essays by people who have lost children in particular. So there's Shakespeare and Richard Ford and Mark Twain and Abraham Lincoln, people who you wouldn't think have lost a child.
Right.
And the crux of it is that, you know, you go on, but there isn't really any this notion of acceptance. So, you know, and you move on, this notion that time will heal all wounds. I mean, Eleanor, what's this continuing bonds theory say exactly?
The thing that I think people find the most comforting about continuing bonds is finding a way to incorporate that loved one that they've lost into their everyday life, their remembrance, into their rituals, and into just how they go on to their day-to-day activities. And it's just finding a way to stay connected with that person through remembering, through honoring, and through starting a different relationship with that person.
And Lisa, I mean, how do you do that without people saying, oh, you're nuts, you know?
Well, I think that's the biggest challenge for people is they think if it's 5 years later and I'm still talking about my son that I lost, that people are going to think I'm crazy, I haven't coped with the loss, I haven't moved on. So I think people become very self-conscious about remembering and talking about their loved one. One of the things from the beginning, I think, is connecting with other people who've had similar losses to realize that most people are maintaining some sort of continuing bond with that person. They have ways that they remember them in their everyday life. Maybe it's at holidays, maybe it's at birthdays, maybe it's a ritual that they just do every day to spend some time honoring and thinking of that person. Maybe it's just a little display they have in their home. There's a huge range of things that people can do. But realizing that that is the norm, it's not the exception to the rule, I think is really important for that to happen early on. And I think it's really important that that communication happens between family members, so that everybody in the family realizes that we're all remembering together and they're not individually and silently remembering, which is something that can happen within families.
So, Lisa Williams, when it comes to rituals like funerals, you write about some things that are changing from these traditional rituals. Give us some examples of what's happening on that score.
One of the things that's happening is funerals are actually going back into the home, which is something that we saw, 100 years ago. We have distanced ourselves from death in many ways. We put it into a funeral home. We kind of wanted to be removed from that. And people now are taking a step back and saying, maybe I want to remember this person in the place that they lived, in the place that was meaningful for them. So we have something now called death midwives, who are sort of funeral directors that orchestrate funerals in your home or somewhere else meaningful for you. It might be the bar. It might be, his favorite place where he went to watch a sporting event, things like that. So really thinking differently about whether these have to be limited to churches and funeral homes and going outside of that.
Well, certainly to anybody who's listening to us this morning, if you're going through a grieving process now, we are sorry for your loss.
Absolutely.
And we appreciate your both coming this morning. Thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Eleanor Haley and Lisa Williams. They live in Baltimore. Their blog is called What's Your Grief? It's a resource for people who are grieving. One of their most recent posts has more on the notion of continuing bonds theory. We've got a link on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. It's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Go to our website to learn more about the segment you just heard, check out our audio archives, or to join in on the conversation yourself. You can also make a pledge to support local programming like Maryland Morning. That's wypr.org/Maryland Morning.
Morning, everybody. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. Over the years on this program, Sheila, Nathan, and I have had the chance to talk to a lot of folks who make movies. We've talked to actors and writers and directors and producers. But last March, I spoke with the producer of a film who will likely be the only filmmaker I'll ever encounter who also happens to be a particle physicist. His name is Dr. David Kaplan. He's a professor of particle physics at Johns Hopkins University and the producer, along with Mark Levinson, of a fantastic documentary called Particle Fever. David is featured in the film, along with a cast of brilliant, dedicated scientists, many of whom are working to develop the Large Hadron Collider. The data that we've garnered by smashing particles together in this, the world's largest machine, has led to a lot of previously unknown or unknowable answers, and it's animated lots of new questions. David Kaplan joined me in Studio A last March. So this is a phenomenal movie. It's really just quite compelling in every way.
Thank you.
And you say at one point in the movie, because you're a major figure in the film itself, you say that we're in a fork in the road, that this is either a golden era, and you're talking at this point before the Hadron Collider is online. You say we're either in a golden era or in a moment that is quite stark, and that there's never really been a moment like this in history. What do you think about that?
Well, the whole reason I thought that this would be an amazing story is that we physicists were up at night a lot thinking not just about equations and detailed properties of whatever theory we're thinking of, but also just about the field itself. It took 30 years to build this incredible machine, partly because of engineering difficulties, but partly for political reasons and sociological reasons. There's not a big constituency out there for particle physics, for fundamental research that doesn't build bigger weapons or make people rich. So we had a feeling, or at least it was nervousness within the community, that if this machine didn't show us that we were on the right path, that the big discoveries were coming, that something might happen. The world may decide to just stop doing fundamental research. There are examples of that in the past. And so I think part of it was the sociological context within we're all living, which is, are people going to support fundamental physics? As well as a question as to whether we are on the right track, are the new deeper underlying theories going to reveal themselves at this machine or not? Do we not have access to that information? That's a decision nature has to make.
The Large Hadron Collider, you say in the movie, is at its core a fundamental experiment. You're going to smash things together, these protons, right?
Yes.
Particles. Yeah. And you're going to try to understand the stuff that results from the smashing thereof. There are four different experiments going on at four different points inside this collider,
right,
where you're collecting data. Describe for us what the thing looks like. You know, where is it? How big is it?
Sure. It's there's a tunnel. It's 16 and a half miles around. It's a ring underneath France and Switzerland. It's right at the border near Geneva. And within the tunnel are superconducting magnets, which allow protons, parts of atoms, to be propelled near the speed of light in both directions. And then the beams cross. You're not supposed to cross the beams, but we cross the beams at four different points around which there are these massive detectors to catch what comes out of the collision. And the purpose for colliding particles is actually we're not looking inside the particles. We're not trying to break them apart. When you push things to extremely high energies, they act like waves. And the particles, this is due to quantum mechanics, which I will not explain on your show, but the waves become very high frequency and you can start to probe things that are very tiny. But we're not probing the inside of the particles. We're actually probing the vacuum of space itself. So when you cause a collision to happen at very high energies, that energy goes into the vacuum of space, and then what gets reflected out teaches us what space-time is made of. And that is really where we are in terms of fundamental research. What is space-time? What are the properties of this universe as a whole? And that gives us an idea of what the universe looked like just after the Big Bang and how it was all created since then.
The fact that it is located in Europe, how has that affected or has it affected in any way the kind of research that's being done? There are more than 10,000 people working on this project from all over the world.
Yeah.
And we had a chance to have it here.
We had a chance to have it here. In the 90s, they were building, in fact, something three times the size in Texas, but they canceled the project.
As a matter of fact, let's take a listen from the movie. You tell us in the film that, as you say, there was a project to build an even larger supercollider in Texas. It was canceled in 1993. Here's a couple of clips that you feature. We'll first hear former U.S. Representative Sherwood Bollert. He's a Republican from upstate New York. That'll be followed by former U.S. Representative Joel Heffley. He's a Republican from Colorado. They're speaking in opposition to the project.
I doubt anyone believes that the most pressing issues facing the nation include an insufficient understanding of the origins of the universe.
And finally, he's saying, well, if we don't do it, the Europeans will do it. Let them do it. We'll steal their technology like they steal our technology.
So a lot of folks would hear that and say that's a little short-sighted.
Well, let me first start by saying this really wasn't a Republican versus Democrat situation. There were Republicans that supported it, there were Democrats that supported it, and there were both Republicans and Democrats who were opposed to it. In fact, it was in Texas, so as you can imagine, people from the South strongly supported it, and people from the North and the West strongly opposed it. But the problem was that, like I said, we really don't have a constituency for fundamental research. There are plenty of constituencies and interest groups for many other things. So it's hard to defend this. And the project is expensive. for a singular thing, but spread it over many years and for the benefits of society. It really is not. It's an investment in real deep fundamental research and also an investment in the long-term future.
Yeah, in the movie you talk about when people ask you why should we do this, you say there's two answers, one that you tell people and the other is the truth.
Yes.
So what are those two answers?
Well, the first one is that we are trying to reproduce the conditions at the beginning of the universe. That gets people excited or scares people. But and that is true in a sense, but what we're really trying to do is understand the basic rules. Is there a simple set of equations that describe all the fundamental interactions of everything? And from that, one could hope to extract many more possible things that could be done and many explanations for why we're here. But it's from a very pure place that we do this research. It's simply not to invent things, it's to discover things. And that, we think, is an important part of humanity and the you know, our endeavors, but it doesn't always get supported the way we'd like.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. We're listening to a conversation I had last spring with Dr. David Kaplan. He's a particle physicist from Johns Hopkins University and the producer of a documentary about the Large Hadron Collider called Particle Fever. In the movie, your mentor, a gentleman with whom you studied at Stanford,
Savas
Dimopoulos, gives a very eloquent summation of why you all in science do what you do.
The thing that differentiates scientists is purely an artistic ability to discern what is a good idea, what is a beautiful idea, what is worth spending time on, and most importantly, what is a problem that is sufficiently interesting, yet sufficiently difficult, that it hasn't yet been solved, but the time for solving it has come now.
And one of the issues that you lay out as a dimension of the basic research here is this notion of supersymmetry, which is sort of one approach to physics, and another, which you described as multiverse. Can you give us a quick primer on those two? And I know that's a horrible thing to ask a scientist to do in a short period of time.
Well, yeah, I mean, the problem is, of course, you want to say the latest and greatest thing in physics, but most of the listeners probably aren't, you know, prepared with quantum mechanics. But in broad strokes, what's going on at the Large Hadron Collider is we are trying to understand if there is a deeper symmetry among all particles, all forces that connect them all and in some sense make the deepest theory very uniform as we get to the beginning of the universe. The multiverse is a concept. It's a framework. It's not even a complete theory, but it's an idea that our universe is one of many. And the many means that in all of those other universes, or at least parts of the universe, the laws of physics are different. And so when you measure the laws of physics, the fundamental rules here, you can ask, is there a deeper reason for those things to exist? And it may be that it's random, that what we measure here, while we think we're getting deep concepts, are actually just some random things that occur in this part of the universe, but not in others. And the multiverse then suggests that there are some things which are not hints, they're red herrings. And so we're trying to figure out if this next stage, the discovery of the so-called God particle or the Higgs boson, is an indicator of a deeper structure to how the universe works, or is it simply a random thing that was thrown at us because of what part of the multiverse we live in?
Peter Higgs, the person after whom the Higgs boson particle is named, as you say, it's referred to in the lay community as the God particle, although I know that physicists don't like calling it that. He's in the movie. He's attends a press conference in which data from the Large Hadron Collider is discussed and announced. It's a very poignant scene in the movie. I'm crying my eyes out watching this yesterday, thinking to myself, I'm crying at a movie about physics. What's going on here? And it's really quite something. But this notion of the God particle, if you'll forgive my use of that term, how does this work, in fact, inform our understanding and our speculation about the existence of a divine being.
Ah.
Oh, that.
It doesn't. Mm-hmm. That nickname was created to sell popular books on physics back in the 80s by a physicist named Leon Lederman. So it was advertising more than anything else. You can try to push the analogy because the Higgs particle is a vibration or an excitation evidence for us for something called a Higgs field, which permeates all of space. And it is the best description as to why certain particles have inertia, like the electron, and therefore why atoms can exist. You need to make sure particles can move slow enough that they can get trapped with each other. So all of matter is formed because things like the Higgs field turned on in the early universe, and it exists today. So in that sense, you can say it's responsible for creation as we know it, and then you can push the nickname.
David Kaplan. He and Mark Levinson produced Particle Fever. We spoke last March. You can find Particle Fever on Netflix, and you can find links to more information about the film on our website, wypr.org/Marilyn Morning. Marilyn Morning is an original production of Your Public Radio, WYPR, in Baltimore. The program is produced by Matt Purdy and Jamila Kay. Nathan Sterner directs and engineers. Our coffee is provided by Zeke's Coffee in Lauraville. They're on the web at zekescoffee.com. We'd love to hear your reaction to anything you've heard on our show. You can leave a comment or make a suggestion about an interview you'd like to hear at wypr.org/Marilyn Morning. That's it for us today. Coming up Monday, Sheila has a discussion about the latest research into autism. Producer Jamila Kay will share an installment in her series Senior Stories, and we'll revisit a conversation with NPR correspondent Margot Adler, who died of cancer last month. I'm Tom Hall. For Sheila, Nathan, and the entire Marilyn Morning team, thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's wypr.org/Marilyn Morning. Thanks for listening.